suppresses, and is the inevitable attribute of the good. One of the primary axioms of geometry that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other may be profitably applied to this Socratic triad. So, in answer to the question, what is the most beautiful of all things? Philosophy says that which is the most virtuous and the most necessary? What is the most virtuous of all things? That which is the most beautiful and the most necessary. What is the most necessary of all things? That which is the most beautiful and the most virtuous. The truth of these assumptions is self-evident. Never has the world realized more clearly the utilitarian value of beauty or how necessary virtue is to the survival of the whole. Much of the crassness with which modern civilization is cursed has resulted from the divorce of beauty and utility, in which the spirit of aesthetics has been sacrificed to what we foolishly term the practical. Some years ago I visited a state prison, and upon being taken into that section reserved for those commonly called lifers, I was struck with the pathetic effort of the convicts to preserve the spirit of beauty behind the drab stone walls of their penal institution. The men had built little wooden flower boxes, fastening them to the foot of the grating of their cell doors. In these boxes were planted creeping vines which, growing upward, entwined themselves about the gratings and made of the iron bars a trellis. Also in the tenement districts of large cities where thousands are huddled together in an atmosphere of squalor and vice, the little potted geranium on the fire escape is a familiar spectacle, bearing witness to that spark of aesthetics which the Lord of the whole hid deep within each human heart. Although to a certain degree an intangible asset, beauty is the molding factor in racial and national life. As long as the spirit of the beautiful shines forth through the bodily structure of peoples and institutions, these increase in power and glory. But when aesthetics dies, the very structure of society deteriorates and begins its march toward inevitable oblivion. Beauty is a soul quality, and like the soul is visible only in its tincturing. 174 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Tihi Mission of Aesthetics. 175. Effect upon its immediate environment. When life is actuated by the spirit of the beautiful, the entire organism, social as well as individual, is the beneficiary of a definite grace and charm, which render a relatively imperfect body not only endurable, but even attractive. It is not given that all human beings should have beauty or symmetry of form and features. As we pass through the Hall of Fame, where the likenesses of the world's illustrious are preserved for the admiration of posterity, if mere physical symmetry be regarded as the sole criterion of excellence, many of these geniuses were but rude caricatures of men and women, carved deeply in the marble of immortality. We find the crude and distorted face of Socrates, a little farther down the gaunt figure and aquiline features of Dante, while from his niche stares great Milton, whose sightless eyes could yet envision paradise. More recent additions to the immortals are the lank and raw-boned Lincoln and the crippled Steinmetz. Why have the beautiful so often mounted to power through tyranny and oppression, while the deformed have nobly and unselfishly served mankind? The answer seems evident. Beauty has regarded its own existence as a substitute for merit, and fascinated by its reflection in the mirror of vanity, has therefore passed into oblivion. On the other hand, those of unsightly mien have struggled for that transcendent internal beauty which has elevated them to chief place in the hearts of men. That man has a compound nature is difficult for most people to understand. In other words, man is not merely an individual, he is many individuals considered as one. With Sim. Iler propriety we might refer to an army as a single entity. Disregarding the fact that an army is really an aggregation of entities. The brain of man is actually composed of over 40 lesser brains, each a specialized organ of thought. Each of these complete thinking organisms vies with every other to dominate the entire organism of thought, and through this competition of parts the compound mental attitude is established. Unaware of what may be termed the ethical code in the relationship of these brain parts to each other, man believes himself to be the master of his thinking processes, when in reality he is frequently the victim of their machinations. 176 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Throughout the entire constitution of man there is a continual plotting for precedence. To a certain degree each part victim izes its associates, with the result that the organism is a seething maelstrom of biological intrigue. In similar fashion the social order, which is really a vast body, may be likened to the Fabius dragon whose seven heads are continually biting at each other. While the interdependence of parts prevents an open out break, there are few bodies in which even a comparative degree of harmony can be said to exist. The compound human or organism may be fair to gaze upon, but this does not necessarily prove that the various strata of its microcosmic social system are on amicable terms with each other. The human body is one of many examples of the failure of the democratic theory. For nothing could be more tragic than the picture of man's hands or feet liberated to work out their own destiny irrespective of the welfare of the rest. Only because there is within each of us an autocrat who binds the various members to the accomplishment of its own ends can even a semblance of order be maintained. When it is further realized that this autocrat is itself capable of error, in fact, almost incapable of anything else, we may better grasp the problem presented by the government of man's functions. The wonder is not that man manages his affairs so poorly, but that he manages them at all. An individual whose own internal parts are so badly disorganized as to make rational functioning impossible cannot but reflect his own indecisions into the social order of his civilization. The codes by which he lives, being the product of his own internal disquietude, thus engender national and international friction with their resultant crime, war, and disease. Like individual power, racial power must result from the autocratic usurpation of authority by some figure, no matter how despotic and arbitrary, who grasps the reins with a strong hand and drives the whole toward the consummation of its own desires. Men like Alexander the Great, Caesar, Genghis Khan, and Napoleon represent the personification of a racial urge, which Nietzsche might call the will to power. These men. The Mission of Aesthetics 177. Gathered up the belligerent elements which had previously expended themselves in a guerrilla-like warfare of factions and directed them toward the goal of world conquest. While this procedure proved most distressing to the strangers without the gates who were its luckless victims, it alone preserved the political integrity of the exploiting powers. The moment either an individual or a nation ceases to struggle against external obstacles, internal dissensions arise. As soon as the Christian Church stopped fighting the pagans, it began fighting itself. As rapidly as nations reach the point where they are strong enough to maintain an isolated individualism, they are destroyed by civil war. It is sad, but nevertheless true, that up to the present time conquest has been the only force strong enough to surmount national prejudices and cement them into national alliances. There is undoubtedly a certain relationship between this fact and the well-known adage that the devil finds mischief for idle hands to do. as the individual is likewise a nation in miniature, he is only capable of maintaining the efficiency of his separate organisms while these organisms as a whole are directed toward the achievement of a definite end. Though the lodestar of both nations and individuals, ambition has also proved to be their undoing, for, having outdistanced their resources, they were unable to maintain the positions they had gained. An ancient philosopher once said, "If you want to humble your adversary, give him power." Power may be defined as the privilege of self-expression. Only the wise, however, can express themselves and still be great, the remainder reveal their own ignorance and thereupon tumble from their gilded thrones. To the question, what is the most powerful thing in all the world? The financier would answer, money, the general, guns and men, the religionist, the church, the scientist, knowledge, the philosopher, reason, the mystic, love, the aesthetician, beauty. Money, while not inherently evil, has been the motivating principle behind nearly every form of crime known to man. Guns and men, as we know all too well, have become the elements of a gigantic destructive science which may hurl mill 178 lectures on ancient philosophy. Lions of living things to a horrible death in order to establish a diplomatic technicality. The church, founded originally for the worship of God and the service of man, has now become an arrogant institution, looking with contempt upon those who supply it with the wear, with all of its very existence. Knowledge has deteriorated until it is simply a dust-covered stack of dry and worthless notions. Reason has degenerated into debate, wherein minds which should be directionalizing their efforts toward the good of the whole, huddle together under the cloak of learning and mumble their absurdities. Love, the most sacred of all emotions, has been dragged from its lofty pedestal, and crimson-robed lust seated in its stead. As for beauty, it has sunk to depths so low as to be considered the vicarious atonement for irrationality. That beauty is a power is undeniable, but the magnitude of that power is as yet unsuspected. As the proper directionalization of beauty is a potent factor in the civilizing of races, so the misuse of this agency results in a corresponding degree of depravity. External beauty combined with the insolence of internal pride produced a Lucrezia Borgia who, with a face as beautiful as that of a saint, poisoned without a qualm of conscience all who stood in her way. Yet it is written of Lucrezia Borgia that despite her surpassing beauty there was an intangible something about her which filled everyone in her presence with indescribable fear and loathing. Thus the internal nature is impossible of total concealment, and where the outer beauty does not complement the grace within the soul, an incongruity surrounds the personality like an intangible miasma. The warring segments of a personality, as has been suggested, can only be unified by a common purpose which will enlist the sympathetic cooperation of all. Right motive. One of the eight noble paths of Buddhism can be made to unite all the diversified faculties and members of the nature and directionalize them toward achievement of the greatest good.